Cosmic Shed. Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. It's just me, Andrew, in the shed today. And if you're anything like me, this mid-season break in Star Trek Discovery is getting you down a bit. What a brilliant first half of the season it's been. Brilliant science fiction, brilliant Star Trek. And I hope you've all been enjoying it as much as I have, and I know the rest of the Shed crew have. And as I was watching the last couple of episodes with the Parvans sending out their message into the cosmos to beckon civilizations towards them with peaceful intentions, it made me think of METI here on Earth, which is a non-profit research and educational organization devoted to transmitting intentional signals to extraterrestrial civilizations. And its president is Douglas Vakoch. He is an American Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence researcher, a psychologist, and the president of METI. And METI have just sent out a new radio signal out into space to the nearest known potentially habitable exoplanet, the nearest planet outside our solar system that we know of that could possibly have life on it. So while we wait for the next installments of the adventures of Captain Lorca, Michael Burnham and the rest of the crew, who I really hope we see much more character development with in the rest of the season, and of course season two, I caught up with Douglas Vakoch and began by asking him what he'd taken from these first few episodes of Star Trek Discovery.
Well, I think as in really good science fiction in general, Star Trek Discovery gives us an opportunity to think anew about something as fundamental as communication. So, why is it that civilizations want to make contact? Is it to explore? Is it to understand? Is it to express themselves? And, you know, I think we've been seeing variations on that since the beginning of the series.
I'm thinking particularly of the Parvan, I don't know how you pronounce it, Parvan civilization, this peaceful species that look like, I mean, they're amazing to look at. They're just sort of really ethereal things, really, aren't they? Floating around the forest. And their motivation appears to be entirely, we are a peaceful nation, peaceful species, a peaceful planet. We love the nature and we want to share with the rest of the universe our message of peace, and we want to find other species that share our message and learn about the universe around us, which speaks volumes to scientists and METI and SETI. But they do that, and then the Klingons arrive on their doorstep.
Well, and the Klingons arrive, right? So again, the context is that the Federation is going to the planet Pavo because they want to use this crystalline transmitter that the Pavans have created, that, as you say, they're using to send welcoming messages to the cosmos. But the Federation landing party wants to use it for their own purposes, which is to turn it into something that can detect the cloaked Klingon ships. So, and, you know, they want to use it for their purposes, but the Pavans say, this is not how we operate. You know, we don't take sides here. In fact, we're going to send out a welcome, but we're going to send it out at frequencies that both the Klingons and the Federation use so that you can all come here. So it wasn't what the Federation landing party had wanted, but it's what they got, because the desire of the Pavans was very different than the desire of the Federation. You know, the Federation was, we have to protect our own Federation. Mm-hmm. The Pavans said, look, you've got a conflict here, and we're going to handle it by getting you both here, and now we'll resolve it.
Mm. And, right, so just to speak about the science of Star Trek more widely, so do you think we've found ourselves in a mirror universe?
So have we found ourselves in a mirror universe? In some sense, because when we see good science fiction, it forces us to look at ourselves anew. It forces us to sort of get out of ourselves a little bit. And, you know, one of the things that struck me about the Star Trek Discovery episode about Pavo is this sense that the planet as a whole has a certain consciousness. Now, ecologists have used the Gaia hypothesis to talk about the interconnectedness of all life. But, you know, we don't usually think of that as life at the level of consciousness. But again, on this planet, we have a form of life that, as you say, is ethereal. It doesn't pick up on the tricorders as even a living creature, but it has a different manifestation. To me, the mirror that this episode holds up to us is just to say, what is your motivation in making contact? I think a lot of the messages we have sent in the past to other stars have focused on saying, you know, here's who we are and here's why we're so great. So if you look at the Voyager recording, it was, here's a celebration of all that we're proud of on Earth. There was an intentional decision not to include any images of war or poverty or disease. But I think ironically, if we switch around, instead of thinking, what do we want them to know about us, and think, what might they be interested, what might be beneficial or helpful for them, I think the message we send is quite different. Instead of saying how powerful we are, how wise we are, which, you know, I suspect on a galactic scale, we're maybe not that powerful, maybe not that wise, but we are very young. I mean, we are just within the first century of being able to send out our messages. So to my mind, that's the most important thing that we can actually explain. What's it like to be a species that we don't know if our culture is going to exist in the coming centuries? We don't know what we're going to do with our planet. And so I think sometimes reflecting on the things that we try to hide, some of our insecurities, may be some of the most intriguing things, especially to a civilization that has been around for millions of years, has a stability that we really can't imagine. So I think Star Trek Discovery forces us to think about, what are the goals of communicating? Is it to express ourselves? Is it to say something beneficial to the other? Is it, as in the case of the Pavans, to bring together those who are in conflict? And the clearer that we can get about what our knee-jerk reaction is, the more we can think about other alternatives.
Well, the Parvans are sending messages out into space, but so are you. And perhaps we can go right back to the beginning. What is METI?
METI can be contrasted with SETI. So many people have heard of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. This is something astronomers have been doing since 1960, using radio telescopes to look for intentional signals from other civilizations and around other stars. But METI reverses the process. And we send powerful, intentional signals with the hope of eliciting a reply.
Okay, great. But haven't we been sending messages out unintentionally for a long time? You know, and the more we put radio programs out and TV programs out, we're not sending those out into space as well.
You know, one of the changes of telecommunications, radio and television, over the past few years has been a shift to more communications across fiber optics. And so it may well be some of the radio transmissions are still going out into space, but those communications are much more diffuse, because what we want to do when we send radio signals and TV signals here on Earth is to reach the widest audience possible. So they're going in all directions. That's quite different from what we're doing with METI, because we're focusing all of the energy at one point in the sky so that it can be a much stronger signal. But it's the same sort of technology. And, you know, we humans at this point do not have the capacity to pick up the level of leakage radiation that is going out now, or that went out when the signals were even stronger a couple of decades ago. But if we imagine the increase of capacities of our radio telescopes we've seen since radio astronomy began in the 1930s, we will have the ability to detect our own relatively weak leakage radiation out to a distance of, say, 500 light years in just the next couple of centuries. So we're really on the cusp of being able to detect even some of these weak signals. But just as Earth has gotten more silent over the decades, as we use more targeted communications, so satellites directly targeting the Earth, or using fiber optic communications, we are becoming less evident. And so METI is a way of letting other civilizations know, not only are we here, which we assume they've already been able to pick up, but we are interested in making contact.
Yeah, okay. So how long has METI been around, and how many sort of messages have you sent out? Is it, does it work like that?
It does work. You know, there have been a handful of messages that have been sent out by various groups over the years. Our organization, based in San Francisco, was founded in 2015, and we have just now, in October, sent out our first message. This is a message sent from the IceCat transmitter in northern Norway, north of the Arctic Circle. This is a facility that's typically used to study the upper atmosphere, to understand the northern lights, aurora borealis. But it can, and so radio signals are bounced off the atmosphere. A small fraction of them come back, and it lets us say something about the composition, the structure of the atmosphere. But that same telescope can be adapted to pinpoint a particular star. And so our first transmission, in cooperation with a Barcelona-based music festival, Sonar, went out in October 16th, 17th, and 18th. We transmitted on three successive days. And the target is a red dwarf star that is a mere 12.4 light years away. It's called Leuten Star. The other name for it is GJ273b. And actually, the B part refers to an exoplanet that orbits it. So there is a planet that is a super Earth, a bit bigger than the Earth, but it's at just the right distance from that star that it could support liquid water. And so this is the closest known potentially habitable exoplanet thing that can be targeted from northern Norway.
Okay. What's the message? What have you said to the potential inhabitants of that planet?
We have sent a message that, first of all, SETI scientists around Leuten Star would be able to confirm, because that's the biggest challenge that SETI astronomers have. We find a signal, it looks good, but if it doesn't repeat, what do you make of it? Mm-hmm. And so our signal, each day of the transmission, repeats twice, so it's sent a total of three times each day, and then 24 hours later, we go back and send the same message, and then 48 hours later, go back and send the same message. And in April 2018, we'll go back 6 months later, so that the astronomers who are looking for the signals will be able to contact their buddies at other observatories and say, hey, are you able to see this as well? Mm. So that's one of the fundamental characteristics of how we designed the message. But you asked about the content specifically.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I wish I could tell you that the folks on GJ273b would speak English or French or Swahili. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So we need to think about the universal language that we have. And, you know, the only thing that we have in common is this signal that we are sending and they're receiving. And so then the question is, what do they have to know to pick up our signal? Well, if they can build a radio antenna, that means they're good engineers. And it seems like to build something of that magnitude on any world, you need to know a little basic math and physics. 2 + 2 = 4. So that's what we start with our tutorial. We teach them how we count, how we do basic arithmetic. And then the rest of the message revolves around describing the nature of the signal itself. Because, again, we're sending two slightly different frequencies. Think of it as sending ones and zeros, a binary message. And we then make reference to that signal itself. So it's at two different frequencies. When we introduce the idea of a radio frequency, we can describe that numerically, but then point to one frequency and the other frequency. Mm. When we talk about time, we can do it by sending pulses of a certain duration. So that's what the extraterrestrials actually have. That's the raw data that they have. So we're making our message tightly linked to that message itself. Because, you know, it would be nice to think it's going to be easy to understand an extraterrestrial. I think it'll be very tough. So our goal is to get across at least a few essentials for this first message, and then follow up 6 months later with something even more representative of us as human beings.
Okay. And is this the first that they would hear from us? Is there anything else that has gone out from us that could have reached them by now?
Yeah, they are also hearing I Love Lucy and the BBC and all of these other transmissions that have gone out. If they're just a tiny bit more advanced than we are, you say another 100, 200 years more advanced than we are. Mm-hmm. Now, if we had our SETI systems at their location, we wouldn't be able to detect ourselves. Okay. But we have been advancing. The communications capabilities are expanding exponentially. Just a little bit more advanced, and they would be able to know we're here. But what they're missing, and what we're trying to give them, is a sense that we really want to make contact.
Yeah.
Because the Italian physicist Enrico Fermi raised this puzzle back in 1950. He said, you know, if in fact there are intelligent beings everywhere, why haven't we seen them? It's called the Fermi paradox.
Yeah.
And one answer to the Fermi paradox is maybe, in fact, intelligent beings are much more widespread than we had thought, but they are simply out there, maybe even at the nearest stars, observing us. But they're observing us almost like we observe animals in the zoo. It's called the zoo hypothesis. But what happens if you go to the zoo and you're watching a bunch of zebras interacting with one another, but all of a sudden one of those zebras turns directly toward you, looks you in the eye, and starts pounding out a series of prime numbers? That establishes a very different relationship,
yeah.
And you probably respond. And so that's what we're trying to do, to evoke a response. So that, I mean, at one level, that's the way this could succeed. But if you think about it a bit, what that requires is that the entire galaxy is chock full of alien civilizations. Yeah. I think a more realistic scenario is that we need to repeat this process of targeting an individual star multiple times, but do it with 1,000 stars or maybe 1,000,000 stars before we actually find one that's inhabited. So this is an inherently long-term project. We could get a reply back within 25 years, but as we go further and further out, that round-trip exchange time gets greater and greater. And I think that's been the greatest inhibition of doing this, is simply that we human beings are not very good at thinking in the long term.
Yeah.
So for me, if we simply have humans listening for that reply in 2043, I would think the project is a big success, just in terms of being able to plan something that long term and execute it. And to make it a little bit easier, when we go back in April and send our final message, we'll let the extraterrestrials know the specific date that we are going to be listening, and it's June 21st, 2043, the summer solstice in the Northern Hemisphere. Because as we think in terms of long-term transmissions that may occur over the course of centuries or millennia, we also need to think of finding significant dates that are tied into natural cycles of our Earth. Because who knows, given changes of culture and practice, you know, what the important holidays are going to be in the future. But that's something that's actually determined by the motions of the Earth.
Right. Okay, well, I can kind of imagine on the summer solstice,
in 2043.
Yeah, I can imagine a huge party. I imagine quite a lot of parties going on. And to my mind, this is all good. But there have been criticisms. There are concerns, particularly from people like Stephen Hawking, saying we shouldn't be sending out messages. What do you say to that?
Well, I say whenever anyone as brilliant as Stephen Hawking raises a concern, you have to take it seriously.
Yeah.
But as I look at it more closely, it seems to me he has missed one point, which is that any civilization that has the ability to travel between the stars already has the capability to detect our leakage radiation. So we're not letting them know that we're here for the first time. That's the big concern I hear. Oh, we're able to hide, and we shouldn't announce ourselves because they don't know we're here. You know, it's true, again, if we have a twin of Earth's technology at even the nearest star, we wouldn't know of our existence. But we also don't have the ability to travel between the stars. If you get just a couple of centuries more advanced than we are, then we have the capability of detecting our level of leakage radiation 500 light years away. So I just cannot imagine a scenario in which an alien civilization, a hostile civilization that wants to do us harm, wouldn't already know that we're here. And we don't even have to think about just the leakage radiation, the television and radio that Earth has been sending off for the last 70 or 80 years. For 2.5 billion years, our atmosphere has been giving off the evidence that we have microbial life on Earth. And so if you have an especially paranoid civilization out there that wants to, I don't know, wipe out the competition, they've had a lot of time to do it, and there's no evidence that they've been here.
Yeah.
So I don't find, I think it's really important that we look at concerns, because this, you know, what we find, psychologists tell us, that when we go into an unknown situation, we try to assess the risks by drawing upon the most vivid images that come to mind. It's called the availability heuristic. We pick the images that are most available to our memory. And what could be more vivid a notion of a first contact than an alien invasion? But just because it vividly comes to mind and is reinforced by Hollywood blockbusters, it doesn't mean it's realistic. And so I would just say, let's look at the specific scenario and see whether it really is a risk.
Yeah, I have to say, speaks to why I think it's okay, but the first two first contact things that come to mind for me are Vulcans and Contact, both of which went pretty well. So
they did, and you know, I think that the difficulty, of course, we have is that first contact probably isn't going to be face to face. I mean, it is incredibly energy demanding to travel between the stars, but it's really quite cheap to send radio signals. And, you know, we can do that at the speed of light. But the problem then is the ambiguities of communication. And, of course, we see that even as we make contact face-to-face across cultures here. Mm-hmm. But a civilization that's been through this before will know about those ambiguities. And so I think they'll be a little bit patient. But the reality is it may take a few back-and-forth exchanges. And so this is a project for the generations.
Yeah, brilliant. And so if you could, once they can understand what we're saying, we can understand what they're saying. What have you thought about what you'd like to say to them, what you'd like to know from them?
Well, I would want to know what they value in the world. I would want to know what they care about, because I think the greatest value of making contact with an alien civilization is it lets us understand how another intelligence in the universe sees the universe, how they engage with one another. In a sense, it's a way of holding a mirror up to ourselves. Right now, we don't have a good way of comparing ourselves with other intelligence. But just as we learn a lot about ourselves when we meet someone from another culture here on Earth, so too I think we could learn about ourselves from meeting an alien intelligence. So, I would want to know what are their forms of art? What are their value systems? What do they know about the universe that we don't?
Yeah, brilliant. You're a science fiction fan then?
Yes.
Okay, just in case there's any I don't know, where would you go if you're thinking, okay, I want to watch some science fiction, but I don't want to get too far away from the day job, so I want to do some First Contact, I want to do some SETI, I want to do some METI. Where should I look for it in science fiction?
I really like the recent movie Arrival, because even though it has the aliens coming to Earth, and that makes the whole process much easier to have a back-and-forth exchange, it did highlight the ambiguities of understanding the language of another. I mean, even what is this? Is it something that could be understood mathematically? Is it something that is more like a verbal or a visual communication? The other thing I like about Arrival, so again, this is a spoiler for anyone who hasn't seen it, but the movie forces us to even rethink something as fundamental as time. Now, I don't imagine that when we make contact, we'll discover that time really runs backwards, but I think that's a nice metaphor for how radical the shift of mindset will be if we can really get into the mindset of an alien species. And so I think that's the big advantage of science fiction. It helps give us this initial stretch of trying to get outside of ourselves. And then once we do, we can come back and say, not that we should change, or that, you know, I think sometimes people think that that first contact is going to either lead to the annihilation of life on Earth or our salvation. I don't think either of those is realistic. I think what we can expect, though, is that it will give us an expanded awareness and a better way of comparing ourselves to others.
That's Douglas Vakoch. Thank you so much for talking to me. An absolute pleasure. We'll be back very soon with another episode on Blade Runner. This time it's the making of, and that should be out next week. And if we can work out a time to get them here to the shed, we're going to have an episode with two of the producers from the amazing new BBC series, Blue Planet 2. And thank you so much for listening. Goodbye.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.